That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Everything good? Is everything good with me? No, I've only just got my voice back. I'm still filming and it's been a bit of a big week for us. So I'm going to tell you about it very briefly. I'm not going to bore you. So Saturday, we went up to North by Northwich with the Charlatans and we had two big live episodes to record. The first one with Hassie and the legend, Mr. Dave Haslam, talking about his fantastic book, Sonic Youth, Slept on My Floor, and among all other stuff. And that's going to be a great episode coming out soon. And then we walked over the road to the Odeon Northwich. Big shout out to all the people who work at the Odeon Northwich, because they were just fantastic and lovely, because we were in screen three, because there was a Journeyman screening. But before that, we had the live episode of the podcast with Paddy Considine. And it was just brilliant. I think everybody really loved it. I really loved it. You'll hear more about that in the coming weeks. But trust me, you're going to absolutely love it. And then we had to jump in the two-shot podmobile, which is Griff's car, load up and leg it to Crewe train station, because we were going to London. We had to go back down to London for the British Podcast Awards. We met our friend Matt Ford, who is a fantastic stand-up, and he does a very good podcast called The Political Party Podcast. You should check that out. We had a quick drink with him, and then we all walked up the road to the Podcast Awards. And we won. We won Best Culture Podcast. And I'm still blown over now. Blown over, blown away, overwhelmed. I don't know. You see, I can't even speak. We were absolutely thrilled. We couldn't believe it. You know, this podcast hasn't been going even a year yet. So to be recognised is a huge honour. And we just want to shout out to you, because you're talking about it, you're telling other people about it, and it's catching fire. So we're absolutely made up. And thank you so much for all the lovely messages that you sent us on social media. We're just thrilled. We're just thrilled. I'm not going to speak anymore. I'm sounding ridiculous. So if you're listening to this on Thursday night, we are at Bath Festivals doing another live podcast. Why do I do this to myself? I'm filming at the moment in London and I've got to go to Bath. But I love it. Look, I wouldn't change it for the world, and I'm not moaning, because Thursday night we are going to sit down with the writers, creators and stars of the BAFTA winning absolutely bloody brilliant show, This Country, Charlie and Daisy May Cooper, and I couldn't be more excited. I've been a massive fan of both of theirs since it started, and we're going to see what happens. Who knows what's going to happen? We are going to be at the Waterstones in Bath from 7. If you've got tickets, get there for about 10 to. If you haven't got tickets, maybe try your luck. See if there's one going spare. It's going to be a great night. Oh, I'm boring myself. Let's get down to it. This is episode 44 of the Two Shot Podcast with the, frankly, quite brilliant Mira Sayal. I shall see you at the end, if I have a voice left. I hope you enjoy it. Cheers. I've never been to Wolverhampton, even though I live actually not too far away from there.
Do you?
Well, I live in Gloucestershire, so...
Oh, I suppose, yeah.
I suppose I'm an hour from Birmingham, and then I'm not far, am I?
Nice. Not go and have a look.
Really?
I've been to Wolverhampton, but I've never been to me. It's a great song, though.
Tell me about growing up. Because you were born in Wolverhampton, weren't you?
I was born in New Cross Hospital, Wolverhampton. Very famous. Enoch Powell's constituency. Very ironic. Then my mum and dad lived in a boarding house for my first year, which I don't remember. Apparently I slept in a drawer, which I think is very exotic.
And then, that's very cool.
It's very cool. And then they moved to a mining village, sort of between Cannock and Wolverhampton. Very rural. So I was a country girl, grew up in Black Country Mining Village.
Did you?
Yeah, it's great.
So it's your mum and dad, it's you,
mm-hmm.
it's...
And I have a younger brother.
Younger brother. What's the age difference between you and your brother?
7 years.
7 years?
Yeah.
You got on with your brother?
Yeah, I adore him. He's really, really cool. He was like my little doll when he was younger.
Was he?
Yeah.
Did you dress him up?
I did.
I bet he loved you.
Yeah. I show him some of the pictures now and he's horrified. Look, here's you in that little yellow fluffy hat that makes you look like a chicken. I loved that.
Did you like the countryside?
I think I lucked out, actually. When I talk about my rural, working class, very white childhood, the first thing people go is, oh, God, it must have been really tough. And you go, oh, well, you know what? Around it, yes, sometimes, obviously. It was, you know, the West Midlands and the 70s. But what I did have was complete freedom in a way that all the other Asian kids I knew, like kids like me, first generation immigrants born here of immigrant parents, they were all in the Asian areas, so they were policed in a way that I wasn't.
Like in the cities, you mean?
Yeah, because, you know, it's a sort of natural instinct of any immigrant group when they first arrive is to find your tribe, set up your shop so you can buy your food, the places where you worship, stick together, you know, because you feel unsafe. You've made the most epic upheaval of your life, and you want to be where it's familiar. My parents were really unusual. They went right away from that. Consequently, I grew up just being a country wench, really. I would leave the house sort of, especially on weekends, when sort of after breakfast, and my mum would literally have to come and shout for me in the fields. And that was it. I, you know, so rode my bike, scrumped.
You were the black country Heidi.
I was, yeah. And I loved it. And it actually, I don't know, it was Wordsworth that said, wasn't it, that being around nature forms your spiritual landscape. You know, if you're surrounded by beauty and magnificence, that's how your heart will develop. And I feel that the endless horizons of my childhood just gave me this big kind of vision. I didn't see my world as small. I saw it as huge, because that's what I saw. I saw horizons and trees and fields and sky. And I used to sit on the swing and swing, you know, we used to go so high, we almost used to go over the bar. Yes. And I could see beyond the fields, and I'd always think, ah, the world's bigger than this. What's there? What's over there? I want to go there.
God, that's very telling, you know, tracing that back to your career now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even then, the creativity, your mind was going and thinking about the bigger picture.
Yeah. And in fact, it's a bit of a gift, actually, I think, to be a kid with two cultures or between two cultures or however you want to put that. I always consider myself blessed with biculturalism, because not fitting in somewhere and not belonging anywhere is essential for your artistic third eye. I don't know if you've ever had that feeling when you're going through something really emotional, you've just had a bereavement or there's something terrible happening. For artists, there's a bit of you that's standing outside it going, oh, I must remember that emotion when I have to do a scene like that. I must remember that line that I just said if I ever have to write a scene like that.
Yeah.
You're always slightly outside things, trying to see the bigger picture of what this means.
You think about that just like, you know, we're in London now recording this, but if you're walking through the bustling streets of Soho, oh, and you see a couple having some sort of argument, and you, because we watch and we take magpies. And we steal, and
yeah.
you know, we learn what's going on there, and then you start to create their
their backstory and what's going on with them.
Yeah, that's part of the pleasure of I think, being a creative, is that you always want to know, firstly, what is the story, and secondly, what does that story mean? And so, you know, a lot of people are not forced to ask those questions in their life. Why am I here? Where do I belong? What do I want? If you're a kid growing up like I did, you're asked it nearly every day. What are you doing here? Why are you here? Why don't you go back to where you came from? So actually, you need to know where you've come from. You need spiritual awakening and you need political awakening to actually go, I know why I'm here. History brought me here. Colonialism brought me here.
Yeah.
And I know where I want to go, I think, because you keep asking me who I am. I'm going to find out.
Yeah. And what initially took your mum and dad there? Was it work?
My dad actually was offered a postgraduate place here in philosophy, which, of course, is a very useful subject for a newly arrived immigrant. Everybody wants an Indian philosopher. Go and drive the bloody bus. What are you talking about? So, strangely, he found that not very useful in his new life. So he ended up, it's so bizarre, an artistic, creative man, became an accountant. I think he hated every single day of his life.
Really?
Yeah, because he, you know... That's what first-generation immigrants do. You go, am I going to feed my family?
Exactly. He was a provider.
Yeah. Yeah. But in his spare time, he sang and he wrote poetry, and I'm sure that's where all that came from. So he came over to study and then quickly knew he couldn't survive on a student grant, and I just married my mum and wanted to bring her over because I wanted to be together. And mum came here to teach and was invited by the British government, actually, as she reminds me. At that point in India in the early 60s, the British government were very actively recruiting skills from overseas. So there were notices in the newspaper, and she went to a hotel where they said, we'll give you a voucher, we're so happy to have you, you're a graduate, please come over and teach in our schools. And of course, that's how many of the NHS workers came over, by invitation. Sort of important to remind people of that.
I think it is extremely important.
So that's how they both ended up.
And forgive me if I'm wrong, was that from New Delhi?
Yes, from New Delhi. Yeah, yeah. They'd been married a year or so, and they were a bad combination of sort of poor and talented. So they knew they wouldn't get very far. They didn't have rich parents that could get them into this, that and the other place. And in their eyes, Britain was a meritocracy. It was where it didn't matter who you were. If you worked hard, you could make something of yourself.
Yeah. I think that's so brave, the move to the countryside with you and your brother.
Yeah.
I'm quite fascinated by that.
It's really fascinating. But for my mum was a village girl. She grew up in a village in Punjab from a Sikh family, and they were landowners. And so she'd grown up literally, you know, pulling stuff off the trees on the way to school to eat, or taking her granddad's mug down to literally under the goat's udder. He'd go and get me some milk, and she'd go and go, whoop, and squeeze and take it back. Really, really rural. And, you know, just ate amazing food all the time, and her life was very simple and happy. And
kind of romantic, though, as well, those things. Yeah. Those things kind of get me.
Yeah, yeah. We don't talk about that we have to shoot in the hole, because that just spoils it, doesn't it?
Yes, but,
yeah,
ruin
it really spoils it. But she... You know, you can imagine the homesickness that she felt coming to Britain.
I can't even begin to imagine.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, in their first year of marriage.
Yeah, yeah. And Britain in the 60s, you know, no Irish blacks and dogs in a boarding house.
Yeah, all of that shit to deal with
That. So she was massively homesick. And the only thing that made her feel better was to be around nature, because it reminded her of home. And so when this miner's tithe cottage, as it was, came up in this little village, and all their friends thought they were mad. Come to Wolverhampton. You can buy your masala on the street corner. What's the matter with you going there? But my mum was like, no, I want to see the sky and the trees and smell the earth, and that's the only thing that's going to keep me happy. So that's how we ended up there.
That's incredibly strong of your mum.
Yeah, she is.
I think it is.
She's very strong. Spine of steel.
Do you know, you were saying before... And you were, in a way, you were generalising because you weren't being specific, that people would say, what are you doing here? Mm. Where are you from?
Yeah.
Tell me about school. And did you encounter prejudice like that at school?
Yeah, I think all of us did. I think all of that generation did in some form or the other. I never got it from the people we lived cheek by jowl with in the village, because...
they were quite accepting.
Well, yeah, I think their criteria was, are you a good villager or a bad villager? That's all they cared about.
And you were the former.
And we were all on the bottom of the social heap together, you know. And actually, it's such a shame that the sort of constant demonisation of the white working class that's gone on over the last 20, 30 years, because actually my memories of white working class were very warm, welcoming, hard-working, generous people. And a total community. Literally, everyone would watch each other's kids because there was a park. There's all those sort of cottages encircled a big dirt yard where people would park their cars, work on their cars, and the washing lines were up and some of the kids were playing. Then literally next to it was a park. And beyond that was the fields, and that was our playground. And you would look out for each other's kids. Now, when people came up from the local estate to use the park, or when I ventured out towards, you know, this side or that side, yes, it would be a different story, because I stood out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. And you could feel that, even at a young
age. Oh, and you
age.
Got called it. Yeah, yeah. Daily. I mean, could be daily. You just learn to... You learn to toughen up. You know, because I sort of learned early on, I thought, if I look like a victim...
You're going to be treated like one.
Yeah. So...
Did you learn to sort of block out things like that? Because, you know, the hurtful name calling and things like that you would have had at that time.
Yeah, I always went on the circumstances. If there's a gang of 10 of them and just you, head down. Head down, walk on, you know, swallow the anger, put it in your work.
Yeah.
Smaller groups than that, one-to-one, yeah, I'd always take them on. I was a bit scrappy.
Well, yeah.
I was a bit scrappy.
Fierce mirror.
I was. It's not a side of myself I'm always proud of, but I think it served me quite well in my life. I'm not saying you start with your fists, but I do think you have to really be able to stand your corner, you know, verbally and
be articulate.
Absolutely.
Someone said that to me the other day. If you're going to go into an argument, be articulate.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really good bit of advice because sometimes I my brain doesn't connect with my mouth. I know. I just kind of mumble. I just have to get it all out. A sort of cloud of anger.
You just reminded me of one of my favourite scenes from Father Ted where he's telling off the Randy Milkman. I don't know if you remember that episode.
Oh, my God, it's a great episode. Where the speed episode.
He's saying, you know, you've impregnated off the women on the island, and the Milkman says, you're not actually advocating contraception, are you, Father? And Ted just stands there and goes, well, yeah, but feck off! And I go, yeah, I've been in the feck off position sometimes.
I think we all have.
Yeah, but you know, it's much better that you try and find, I suppose that's where humour came in, actually, now I think about it. I mean, people don't want to hit the person who's making them laugh.
No, especially if that... there's other people around that circle who are all laughing.
Yeah, yeah.
At the other person.
Exactly. It's a really powerful
weapon.
And
then the balance just tips.
Absolutely.
And then we feel strong because we found that humour.
Yeah.
And did that come quite easy to you at school?
Yeah, I think I was... I mean, I grew up in a family where we, you know, had a lot of laughs. My mum and dad were very sociable. I mean, all their friends were Punjabi, but, you know, they'd all pile into each other's houses on the weekend, and we'd have these music parties, and there'd be a lot of banter and a lot of laughter, actually, and a lot of verbals. And we were all encouraged to do our little party pieces, so, you know, that's where the performance started. I'd sing some Hindi songs with my dad, or he was playing the harmonium, and then I'd do my songs on the guitar, like Paper Roses by Marie Osmond. That was a favourite. Wowed the aunties. She'll never go anywhere. They'll never go anywhere. So the performance thing started early, but I think the love of words and the banter and actually seeing how positive a force humour was for that generation, going through a lot that they didn't tell us about, but we would find out about later, that seeing them sort of shrug off all of their cares and their workaday clothes and seeing the people they used to be.
Yeah.
And the people and the dreams, some of them were the dreams they'd left behind, you know, the poets and the writers and the songwriters and, you know, bringing artistic skills with them that they couldn't use in England because they weren't valuable and nobody wanted to hear them. But to see them giving vent to that was really beautiful.
And I bet it was inspiring as well.
Yeah, and also made me understand all the hidden stories, all the neglected stories, all the bits of history that we're not included in, all those journeys that aren't told. So I became really passionate about refinding those.
And were you academic at school?
I was a bit of a worker. I was, but again, that was... It was the stuff I loved.
So you threw yourself into the stuff that you were passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, I was terrible at maths and terrible at science, so, you know, all plans for me to be a brain surgeon were quickly abandoned. But I was really, really good at English and had a facility for languages. And as it happened, sadly, I had an English teacher who was actually quite openly racist.
No way.
Yeah. We had this discussion about immigration in the class. This was, you know, really at the time of the National Front were very... marching all over the place and everywhere. And I thought, well, that's quite interesting. We're having a discussion about immigration. This is good. We should do this in English lessons. And then she bookended it by, yes, well, I think we should send them all home. Anyway, turn to page...
She didn't.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I was one of three girls of colour in my girls' school. So that was...
Three.
That was meant for me. And I thought, right... I'm a kid and you're a teacher, so I don't have a lot of power here, but I am going to shame you by being so good at English that it will stick in your throat every time you give me an A. So I did that.
You can't not ignore this.
Yeah. So it was fired by something. But I genuinely loved it. And because my parents were, you know, so liberal and supportive and loving, probably because, you know, they eloped themselves. They were a sort of very romantic backstory of different religions, got married, so I think they understood, they had rebels' hearts, really. So when it looked like I was artistic, they, unlike many of my other friends who had the same leanings, they supported me.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, because they had realised a very wise thing. If you're passionate about something, you'll work at it.
And you'll work hard. And you'll be happy.
And you'll be happy.
Because let's not remember that, please.
And it won't feel like work. Like me and you now. This doesn't feel... I mean, every time I get a job, it's like, am I really getting paid for this? This isn't work. This is who I am.
I was talking before to somebody and we were going, wait a minute. We used to do this as a hobby or just to mess about for free.
For free. I know.
And now we're getting paid... for it. Oh, you know, sometimes you have to stop and go, fucking hell, I am very lucky, to do what I do.
Yeah, yeah. And who would have thought that, you know, I could make a living from it? But so importantly, I got that love and support early on.
Yeah. Which means the absolute world.
It really does.
You could have had a set of parents who went, that's all very well and good, but you need to do this because this is the right and in inverted commas, proper thing to do.
And I had a lot of other Asian friends that happened to. In fact, the majority of them. You know, great if you want to be a doctor or do pharmacy or do law or do the respectable professions, but there were a few of them that didn't, and there was just no concept of anyone from our community at that time.
I was going to say, at that time. Yeah,
making something artistic your career. I mean, who do we have? There were no role models. There was, other than Bollywood stars, there was no one in this country we could point to and go, well, they've done it. They're doing it, so maybe it's possible for me.
I was going to say, was there anybody that you inspired you and looked up to at that time? There probably wasn't, was there?
I can't really think of certainly any Asian women. I mean, there was a show called Junior Showtime. I don't know if you remember that. It's really old. And it was a sort of kids' talent show. And it was presented by a really young, beautiful Asian woman called Aisha. Never forgotten her. She was the only one I ever saw. And her sidekick was Fred the dog, who was a puppet.
Right.
Which, in my eyes, this was the best job in the world. To be next to Fred the puppet would be my dream. Yeah. And she was there. But then, other than that, it was, you know, it was the odd token, funny, head waggly, let's laugh at the accent sort of walk-on part, or people blacked up. And I think most of my inspiration probably came from black actors in Hollywood and black writers, because it seemed to me that in terms of trying to find self-expression as a community, a new community, not that they were, you know, they've been there hundreds of years, but there was no equivalent I could look to in India, because they were people in their own culture and they were doing their own thing. But to see the struggle for artistic expression reflected in what the black activists and writers and actors were doing in America was, I think, more... resonated more with me than anything that was happening.
And also they were standing up and getting their voices heard.
Absolutely. I feel like I've talked really fast and too much.
Yeah. I don't think you talk really fast or too much. Sorry, I was just stopping and I was just thinking about that time and the inspiration that you did or didn't have.
It's so true. If you can see it, you can be it. It is so true.
You did very well in your exams, I'm guessing. I'm not a mind reader, but...
Oh, I'm a good girl, I am. I was a good girl. I did work really hard. I had something to prove, yeah. But, you know...
There was obviously a fight in you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to see what was beyond the park.
And what was the plan beyond the path? Did you have one, or did you feel that you wanted to get out of where you were? To go to get somewhere bigger?
Yeah, I think that was quite strong. Not that I didn't love it, but I knew this wasn't... The world was much bigger than this.
And also it's probably the right thing for you at that time, but you're growing and...
Yeah. So I did English and Drama at Manchester, which was a fantastic course, Manchester Uni. And
how did you find it? Did you like, had you been to Manchester before?
Only for the interview.
Tell me your first thoughts of Manchester.
Well, I was a bit... I was in culture shock, actually, I think, for probably the first year, because I was just 18. I obviously didn't do a gap year because we didn't do that.
Straight in.
And I was from... By that point, my mum and dad had moved to the bustling metropolis of Walsall, so I wasn't a small village girl anymore. I was a small town girl. And I was suddenly in this department, which was really seemed to me full of sophisticates. People that had gap years and were doing things like, yeah, I've just been studying puppetry in Poland. It was really wonderful. Oh, great.
Just, I'm sorry. I know you do revert back to that accent sometimes. How strong was your accent at the time?
It was quite like this, yeah. In fact, so much so that when I told people I was from Walsall, they went, oh, my God, you're a Polish Indian. That's really exotic. No, not Warsaw, Walsall. And then they lost interest. So I was really, I did stick out. I just looked like a bit of a numpty. I sort of wore, you know, the wrong trainers and the wrong jumpers and the wrong accents and... Just, you know, a bit like a puppy let loose off the lead the first time, bumping into things, not really knowing where I was.
In this big city,
but just bursting with joy that here I was, reading books and reading plays and putting on plays.
And just feeding.
Yeah, and I was so hungry and it was so joyful. So the socially, not great for me because I just wasn't equipped that way.
But in what way, making friends or...?
No, I made loads of friends. There were brilliant people there. But, you know, I didn't have boyfriends and I wasn't partying and drugging and doing any of that. But just because I was a bit green, hadn't discovered any of that still at 18. I know that sounds amazing, but that did happen.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I was so in love with the work. I actually would rather go and do the TIE show than, you know, stay up till 5 o'clock and get wasted.
Yeah.
Of course, some people were doing both and probably that's what I should have done.
I think you're doing all right. I think you chose the right path at the moment.
But for me, I think there was a part of me that also thought, I might never get to do this again. This might be the only time. Oh, I'm feeling quite emotional when I'm talking about it. It might be the only time. You know, I didn't know if I'd ever make a living from it.
Yeah.
But it just felt so joyful to be allowed to do it. And so I grabbed every moment and I met amazing people. And the thing that Manchester had was, at that point, was something called the Stephen Joseph Studio, which was our studio. And studio night was Monday night was studio night. And you could be in a play every week if you wanted. It was our space. There was a lighting board. There was everything. Whoever wanted to book it, put on whatever you want. And that, for me, was the thing that made the course brilliant, much beyond the academics, was that that's where we all cut our teeth. And we did some shit stuff, mainly shit stuff.
Of course.
And we did some brilliant stuff. But the point was that the space was there. And how do you know you can write unless you go, I'm going to try and write that. How do you know you can act? How do you know you can write or direct?
Yeah.
That's what education should be about.
Yeah.
Cut your teeth and try it, because you'll find something that you fall in love with and you go, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do.
Because you can't be good at everything.
Of course
nobody
you can't.
Is.
Yeah. And that's what that course gave me. So by the end of the 4 years, because it's a weird one, you come out with two full degrees, you do 2 degrees at the same time. I just, you know, played everything and done everything, but I didn't think that would ever translate to a job in the real world, because I didn't see anybody like me out there doing it. And I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do?
Did that knock your self-belief in your talent or your creativity, because you didn't see anybody like you?
It just... It's such a closed shop, isn't it? And I think a lot of kids from working class backgrounds feel that, whatever race you're from.
Yeah.
And a lot of middle class kids who maybe don't know anybody in the profession. I don't know, maybe it's different. But certainly if you have no in, and remember, I was someone that had only ever seen 2 theatre plays in my life before I actually went to do it at university. You just think, well, how do you do that? Where do you start? Do I write to the BBC? Send them a really polite letter with a picture of me in the back garden going, I would really quite like to act one day. I mean, you know, because I wasn't at drama school. Of course, I knew people that were going on to drama school, so I had a little bit more of an idea at the end of the 4 years at Manchester, but none of them looked like me. I was the only woman of colour in the department anyway. In fact, really? In the whole of the arts department, I think.
God, that's crazy.
It's astonishing, isn't
yeah.
it? Don't remember anybody else. And so you think, well, I know you'll do fine, but your path is never going to be the same as my path.
No.
I just know that. It isn't. There's no point me comparing myself to you. Our careers are never going to be the same. The opportunities we get, the parts we're offered, are never going to be the same. So where is mine?
And did you feel or make a decision then that if the opportunity isn't there, then you're going to create an opportunity for yourself, or did that come later?
Well, now, I suppose this is where luck comes in, and everybody talks about, you know, the big break. I did get a really big one. So it was coming to the end of my 4 years. I had an MA place booked at Leeds Uni to do drama and psychotherapy.
Right.
Because I thought, I'm going to do the sensible thing. I don't think I'll ever get work as an actress and a writer. This was a really nice hobby.
Yeah.
And I know I'm really in love with it, but I'm not sure what's going to happen if I go out there. But I think I could really work with children, and I'd love to use the drama to work with children with learning difficulties. That's what the course was. And then I had a PGCE place booked after that so I could work in schools and with young people. So honestly, my life was really very mapped out.
God, that's a real plan.
Yeah,
you really thought about
plan.
That.
Yeah, yeah. I'm an immigrant kid. Of course, I had a plan. I didn't have a plan B. We
have
plan C,
plan
D, and
B.
E. Yeah. So I did this total conflict between, and I've had it all my life. And in fact, you know, all my Indian female friends, have this continual war between duty and desire all the time. I'm sure. I don't see why other people wouldn't have it too. It depends on how you brought up, but certainly, it was very strong in me. There was the sensible path, not worrying my parents, even though they've shown such faith in me, but you know, how feasible is this? And this pull in me that was, you know, now I look back, I was stamping on it was like I was squashing my soul like a spring into this teeny little box just to go, it's okay, you know, you can be happy this other way, you can be happy, this was really nice, but just be realistic. So this constant conversation with myself. So, you know, got the plan B, C and D. And our university all used to enter shows for the National Student Drama Festival every year.
That you'd penned? No?
Well, I'll go backwards. So,
right.
I, as my swan song to acting, as I thought it was, with my friend Jackie Shapiro, who was a writer, we developed a one-woman show called One of Us, which was basically me playing 15 different characters about this Midland Indian girl who's run away from home to become an actress.
Right.
And it's all set at her first audition. And she plays all the different characters, including her mom and, you know, a boyfriend and a dad. And And she comes in on roller skates with a hat on her head with a prawn on top because she works in this restaurant called Prawn Fantasy in the ballroom. It's a cracker. Anyway, so, and it was like, it was just like I vomited all this stuff that I've been holding in about how I felt about acting, about my life, and about, and of course, this central character was me, sort of auditioning for this piece and realizing she's given up all this and what she's been asked to do in this piece is so demeaning. And she thinks, is this what I've given up my family for? I've run away to do this shit.
Yeah.
To be the third woman behind Ben Kingsley in the next Raj epic. Is that what I've, is that what I've given up my whole community for? So I do this as a one-off performance, you know, at the studio, our studio. And then I'm sort of overwhelmed by, I'll never forget anyone, my dearest friends called Tony Johnson, who still great friends with, who went on to become an amazing drama teacher, just came out afterwards and held me and was sort of crying. He said, I never knew you felt like this. I never knew this was all inside you, and I've known you for 4 years. And I went, no, no, that's why plays are pretty terrific, aren't they, sometimes? They do that stuff. So this play got brought forward with the National Student Drama Festival. It got chosen. It went to the festival itself. It won some prizes. It got chosen to go to Edinburgh. And won some prizes there.
Right.
And literally 2 weeks before I was due to take up my MA place, a director from the Royal Court found me in Edinburgh and said, I'm doing a play with joint stock. It's a year's contract and I want you to be in it.
No way.
And I ran away.
So you did it. You did.
I ran away from my sensible life.
Wow.
And I joined the circus. And that's what happened. And I look back and I go, wow, that was someone in the universe giving me a right old kick up the arse and going, do not be stupid.
Yeah.
You're 22. If you can't take risks now, when are you ever going to?
Exactly.
Be brave. Be brave as a voice in your head. Be brave. What have you got to lose? Nothing. So no one's done it before. So what? You could be the first. Do it.
Yeah.
And then somebody just handed, it's like, and then of course, you know, unpicking that, but I created the work.
Yeah.
So it seems to me like acting is all about that mixture of hard work, lots of sweat, and luck.
Yeah.
But, you know, be ready for the opportunity, but do as much as you can to create it, and being proactive. And I had to be proactive because who was going to write parts for me like me?
Exactly. So, you can't sit around.
No.
I mean, no one can sit around and wait.
No.
But at that time, you couldn't afford to do that. But how fantastic that you put that down and you, it was therapy to get, spew all that out.
I know.
If you hadn't have done that.
And I didn't know if anyone would get it. I didn't know if anyone would find it funny the way I did, because I spent my childhood giggling behind my hand going, is anyone else finding this really hilarious that, you know, those relatives over there are trying to speak, you know, like they're not Indian and they think it's posh. Is anyone laughing about the conversations people are having over there about, we will find the best pharmacist for you, you don't worry. Is anyone else got suitcases on top of their wardrobe like my parents because they're thinking not pal's going to chuck us out tomorrow? Is it just me? Hi! And I felt like the sort of mad voice in the wilderness. And then suddenly you put this stuff down and you go, no, I'm not mad. And people get this because, you know, we all share humanity. We all understand the universal stories.
Yeah.
And that's such a discovery.
And do you think by doing that, that was a start for you to share your experiences and create a wider set of work?
Yes, I suppose so. I just, you know, when you feel invisible, as I did, out there, you have this burning desire to say, we are here and we matter.
Yeah.
And the stories I hear my relatives saying in the comfort of their sitting room, they matter. What brought them here matters. Our history matters. I don't want to be a footnote. I don't want people to forget we were here. So I feel like, it's almost like I feel like I need to record those stories. Otherwise people, I already feel that now with my parents' generation. They're dying off one by one, and I think of all the stories that have died with them, and I'm sad.
Yeah.
And I feel that about everyone's old people, actually. You know, we could all sit, all of you listening could sit with your grandparents and you could have reams of films and plays coming out of their mouths that nobody's asked them about.
Because those stories want to be told.
They want to be
told. It's just no one's asking the right questions.
Ask the right questions. And also finding how healing stories were, that through the stories we share our humanity and that we begin to think about the things that we have in common, not the things that make us different. I think that's why we're all artists. That's why we do what we do.
And there's connections
through
those stories.
Yeah.
Even if it's just one small thing, it could mean the world.
And suddenly we're in each other's shoes.
Yeah. Oh, I get it now.
I get it. Yeah. Yeah.
When was there a time, because you say you felt invisible.
Mm.
Was there a time when there was a change that you didn't feel invisible or you didn't feel alone, even though you weren't lonely, I'd hope?
Yeah. You're never lonely with Indian parents. They never leave you a bloody lone. Believe me. I think the minute I got to London and I suddenly found this whole... I found my tribe, like you do.
Oh, I'm sorry, I need to ask you a question before we move on. Did your mum and dad see that you do that one woman?
Yes.
What was their reaction?
Partly surprised, but also this look on their face like, yeah, we thought she'd end up doing this. they loved it. They loved it.
How did you feel with knowing that they were in the audience for the first time?
I was quite... I thought, you know, this is my sort of love letter to you. You know, I hope you... You know, the reason I've got the confidence to stand here is because you... Yeah.
Oh, that's... Beautiful. So I had to ask that question before it slipped and we moved on.
Oh, they've seen everything I've done. In fact, the best one was the vagina monologues, as you can imagine. I did the vagina monologues and I said, of course, we come to everything. And I took my dad to one side and I said, Dad, I have to tell you, there's no interval. And we're talking about, you know, foo-foos. And you might find it a bit challenging. I'm just saying, you can't escape. And he said, oh, give me the play, I'll read it. So he went off with his pipe and sat in the porch and sort of, I saw him puffing away and reading this and he came back and he tossed it to me and he said, nothing, I don't know. So they came to see the vagina monologues. Very funny.
So going back to not feeling invisible, or if there was a certain time where you...
Oh, yeah. So, a lot, you know, landing in London in the mid to late 80s, it's, 84, 85, the GLC was up and running. London felt like a big free festival. You know, there was so much. The theatre suddenly were waking up to the fact that we were a multicultural country, a multicultural city.
Yeah.
And it felt like... people were actually interested to hear the stories we might have. And so, you know, I became involved with the Asian Cooperative Theatre, the Black Cooperative Theatre. We were all talking to each other, Tara Arts, the stuff that was going on at the Tom Allen Centre, the new comedy that was coming up there. There was just this whole... people like me, first generation, born of immigrant parents... who were born and brought up in this country, felt British, but had a whole legacy of another culture, and had this absolutely unique voice. And it was so exciting. So exciting. And suddenly, I wasn't the mad person in the corner talking to myself. Yeah. I had shorthand with these people. They got me.
Yeah.
That is wonderful. And out of that came, goodness gracious me.
Really?
Well, that whole wave of this second generation finding their voice.
Because I was going to ask about it, because when you're growing up and there's no inspiration there, there's no, I could be like them, I could be like her.
Yeah.
Even prior to Goodness Gracious Me, there wasn't really any sort of comedy show or sketch show like that at all, was there?
Not on mainstream television or radio, yes. I mean, there were pockets of little Asian comedies going on.
Did you, when you all got together, did you say, there's a market for this, we need to change this and we need to open this door?
It wasn't as conscious as that. I had I was one of the writers on The Real McCoy and occasional performer, which was Britain's and still only, shamefully, black sketch show. Black meaning Afro-Caribbean and African. So I was very much a guest on there because, you know, they were very nice to let me in, frankly. But I knew Charlie Hanson and I said, I've got all these characters and I've got nowhere to put them. And I've written a bit of sketch comedy, so they very graciously let me be a guest performer on there. And, of course, I wrote about the stuff that we could do together.
And that was groundbreaking at
the
time.
Yeah, it was. It was groundbreaking, and they were, you know, a brilliant team. And on that show was a young script editor called Anil Gupta, and Kulvinder Gear, as a performer, was also brought in to do a couple of sketches with me. And we used to say, you know, this show is brilliant, but we are guests on it. And actually, the stuff that we've got to say is really different.
Yeah.
And if this can work, maybe could, you know, something like, you know, an Asian sketch show should work. And what is that? We don't know. But Anil had seen Sanjeev and Nitin Sawhney performing on the comedy circuit as the Secret Asians and had been doing for some time. Nina Wadia had also been doing comedy. So he, in fact, put us together and went to John Plowman and said, well, we want to do something like The Real McCoy, but actually very specifically British Asian. And that's sort of where it started.
So it didn't start in the theatre space?
So John, now John denies he ever said this. This has become one of those urban myths, because when we went to him with the idea, he said, "Are Asians funny?" And
fuck off.
And he said, I never said that. I don't think he said it like that. To be fair, John, I love you if you're listening. But he did go, I don't know what British Indian humour is. And we said, well, I don't know if we know, but we can show you.
And we can find out.
The stuff that we've been doing to other people like us, and they seem to find it funny. And so we put on basically a show in Hammersmith at the Riverside and invited all our mates and John and a translator, obviously. And we did all the characters and the sketches we'd been doing.
It's all right, we've been slightly interrupted by people, but please,
we did all the characters and sketches and stuff that we'd been doing on all these little pockets and put on a show, and it was a huge success. And John said, I get it. So first, we were given the weekending slot to do on Radio 4, I think at 10 o'clock at night. It was the summer break. Weekending was a very popular
Weekending. Yeah. Many people started out from
Weekending. Many people, cracking show, sort of a roundup of the news events, satirical. They used to have a summer break. And Radio 4, they didn't trust us with television, which was interesting.
Right.
They wouldn't put us straight on television, but they said, you can have these six episodes for Radio 4 and let's see how you do. They didn't say, let's see how you do, but that was the inference.
Yeah.
So we do these six shows. Again, you know, just doing the stuff that made us laugh, the stuff that was very much from observation of our families and keeping our, you know, Punjabian or Hindian or whatever for when it was needed. So not really ever thinking we're going to do a show to tell white people about what brown people are like. Let's do that. That was never it. It was, it's funny. We think it's funny. Let's see if you think it's funny. If you don't, we've lost nothing. Because who knows who we are. Anyway, the minute that the BBC sat up and took attention of this show is because it became a roaring success. And that told them something really important for their demographic. Asians weren't listening to Radio 4 at 10:30 on a Friday night. This was Middle England.
Yeah.
And Middle England got it. And then they went, aha, maybe we can put this on television.
Mm.
And that's how we got to television. We still had to do a pilot. We still had to wait until that was greenlit. Then we got our first series. So it was not a quick process. We had to prove ourselves quite a few times, but the material was so fresh, I think, and so unapologetic, and we had nothing to lose. And actually, I wish I could be like that all the time. I think that's the thing we lose as we get on in our careers, is to remember that bravery and sort of treat every job that you take on as, I've got nothing to lose, nobody knows who I am, let's just be brave.
Do you feel less brave as you go on?
I think it's much more difficult.
What, personally or within the industry?
Both, I think, yeah.
Have you seen change?
Have I?
Seen change. within yourself, because you're creating stuff at the start and you're throwing yourself to wild abandonment. It doesn't matter who finds it funny. We find it funny. Yeah. This is great. I'm brave. And now, as we get on and we get older, do you find there's more obstacles?
Probably half of those are in your own head. Certainly, when you're unknown and fresh, people are kinder. When you're more known, people will judge you more. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And that's part and parcel of being in the public eye. You've got to take that, you know. You can't. It's not a profession for thin-skinned people. But also, I guess, you're more aware of how the industry works, and therefore, when you write something horribly in your own head, you are thinking about where is this going to go and how can I get this in?
Yeah.
What slot will this go into? Rather than, I'm just going to write this because this is the way I want to write it. Sadly, I know how the business works now, and sadly, I've been proven right time and time again and it's not like I've stopped writing that stuff, but I generally pretty much know when it's going in that probably it's not going to get through because it doesn't tick this, that and that box.
And do you find that difficult as a writer?
Oh, just infuriating. You know, the hardest bit is changing the narrative. I think when we talk about diversity, we're just talking about how many brown or black faces can you see on screen. Now, if you go by that demographic, we're doing pretty well. If you count all the newscasters and the sports people and the this and the that, but it's not a numbers game.
No.
For me, it's about changing the narrative about how we're seen and the kind of stories that we're being seen in. If the only thing you have on your channel all year, which features a substantial amount of Asians in it, is about a paedophile ring, and that is the only thing you're doing, then what are you saying?
Exactly.
It's those bigger questions. I'm not saying don't do that story, but I'm saying put it in context with others. And I think that's the hardest bit, is the stories now a lot of us want to tell might not fit what other people think we should be telling. And I don't know how you change that mindset other than keep plugging away.
When you write a book, do you feel you have more freedom if you're writing like a novel?
Yeah. Undoubtedly you do. It's such a civilised process, but it's so lonely.
I was going to say, well, that must be very difficult, because when you wrote Goodness Gracious Me, did you all write together, or did you go off into groups and write sketches? I don't know how that world works.
Yeah, we'd have a round table thing about what are the ideas floating around, that sounds good, that go away and write that, you write that, bring it back, we edit each other's stuff, sort of have a general... You know, you'd have to fight for something. Sometimes Anil would think something shouldn't go in and we'd fight for it, going on a minute, really, this should go in because of this, this and this. But yeah, generally it was fairly democratic. So,
and to go from something like that to being stuck in a room
on your own with your own head and a blank page,
Was it daunting to do that the first time?
It was, but it was also quite liberating, because actually screenwriting is hard, but the joy of it is that it's collaborative. But you hope that you're collaborating with the right people. It's not like I don't love that bit of it. I do. And you accept that writing is rewriting and you have to kill your darlings, and it will become the director's work when you hand it over, unless you're very lucky and they want you around.
Yeah.
Get all that. Absolutely get all that. So it's not like I don't love that bit of the process. I really do. But there did come a point where I thought, I'm finding getting the ideas I want to do out there so difficult, because it's not fitting in with the general narrative of what they think I should be writing or presenting to them.
How do you think that can change? And there might not even be an answer to that question. Because it's a much larger question than what I've just said, or what I've just asked.
Yeah.
Because if you've spent all that time creating something there, and it gets handed to whoever the gatekeepers over there, and they say, yes, we like this, but X, Y, and Z has to go, and this has to change, and we have to... Well, what do you do there? If you want... It ceases to become your work if you take on board all those notes and those boxes that have to be ticked. So I don't know.
It's a really tricky one. I mean, if you're working with a director and a producer and a script editor, if you're lucky enough to have one that you really trust, I'm happy to go with changes in progress. I really am, as long as I can argue my case and I know why we're doing what we're doing. I think, otherwise you're just not open to learning. You know, the director might have a brilliant idea that I really haven't thought of. The director might go, you don't need three of those scenes, I can do that in a shot. Brilliant, do it.
Yeah.
That's all part
of
the process.
If it moves the story on, then things have to go.
Absolutely, but you have to be part of the dialogue. And first you have to get into the room and then get the idea that is a bit quirky on. I mean, all I can tell you is all the things I've done that I feel are successful would never have been commissioned if I'd gone in with a pitch.
Right.
How they started was from a root of, I really want to tell this story. The very first thing, you know, One of Us, the one-woman show, no one would have commissioned me to do that. No one had seen, I don't know if anyone had seen anything like that before, but it came from a desperation to tell the story. Now, that's what you have to remind yourself of.
Yeah.
I think as you get on, when you're thinking, well, I'd love to get this on, what demographic does that suit? A Sky one, but just not for that?
Yeah.
There's a bit of me that's tempted to go, just write the story you want to write, because actually there must be a reason that all the ones I've done that with have been the ones that have got on and been remembered and had an effect.
It is important to stop and think. It's like what you said before. You were so brave then, and the wiser we get and the older we get, the less brave we get.
Yeah, absolutely. But I just want there to be, really creative, really open discussions, because it feels like sometimes we're all shouting at each other through megaphones and people are getting defensive.
And there's a lot of anger.
And there's a lot of anger.
Which I don't... back to what we're saying about being articulate and passionate It's much stronger than pounding the fist and anger.
Absolutely. And actually, at the end of the day, we all want to tell the stories that are really going to resonate and mean something. But we can't start with being defensive. And when people feel their power is being taken away, they get very defensive. So you have to find that space where we actually are just going, look, dude, I know, you know, you're sitting in that chair with the job that I could probably do just as well, but I ain't going to go there. I just want to really talk to you about let's have a proper grown-up discussion about how we can move forward. You are talking to a grown-up. We're all grown-ups. I got a backlog of stuff. I'm not a baby. So let's just drop all of that rhetoric and just go, what are we talking about here? And you can be open. It doesn't have to go further than this room, but we have to have those really, really deep discussions to affect change, because the people that are holding on to the power are the ones that are the most difficult to reach and the most defensive.
Mirasael, carry on telling your stories. Thanks so much for coming on. That was beautiful.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're bloody welcome. And there we go. Another episode is done. And what an absolutely beautiful episode to end this week on. And what a week. Bloody hell, I need a rest. I bet you do too. But I cannot thank you enough for joining us and being so supportive and talking about the podcast, because without you, we wouldn't be an award-winning podcast. I know that, because you've got behind us from the start. Please follow us. You know we're on Twitter, at Two Shot Pod. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook. If you want to get in touch, you're not on that, you can drop us an email. It's twoshotpod@gmail.com. Oh my God, I've got this down. And also, if you you might think that now we've won an award, oh my God, there's loads of sponsors coming in. They just want... No, no one's coming. We're still doing this off our own back and by the help of you digging in your pockets and helping us out every month. We're on patreon.com/twoshotpod. And remember, if you donate $5 a month or more, I'm going to give you... Do you hear this? What's this? It's only the most beautiful limited edition Two Shot Podcast logo enamel badge brought to us by our friends at One Stop Badges. Now, they made them. They didn't give them to us free. We paid for them. But they are beautiful badge makers. So we go to the best because we want to give to the best. And that's you. All right? If you want one, let us know. We'll sort it. Until next week, take care of yourself. Stay safe. And have fun. All right? Thank you so much for joining us. This has been the Two Shot Podcast. I'm Craig Parkinson. He's producer Griff. And we won a bloody award. Take care. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.